Hello there, and welcome to this episode of the Movies in Focus podcast. I'm Niall Braun. This time around, writer-director Gabriel Abrantes joins me on the podcast to discuss his new film, Amelia's Children, a slow-burning horror film starring Brigid Lundy-Payne, Carlota Cotta, Annabella Moreira, and Alba Batista. Amelia's Children sees a New York-based musician discover that he has a long-lost mother and brother in Portugal. Taking a trip with his girlfriend, he visits them in their secluded mansion, but finds that his family has a dark and deadly secret. As always, I hope you enjoy my chat with Gabriel Abrantes. Well, thank you for taking the time today to join me and talk about the film.
Yeah, of course, a pleasure.
What's it like sort of doing one of these junkets? I'm always curious. I always ask people, what's it like to be out selling something you've made?
Only done one other feature. Like I did a bunch of shorts, but the shorts you don't really do press junkets. Like at a festival, you might, you know, do a little piece or something. But Diamantino, I was sort of shell-shocked. We did like two days straight. And it's sort of surreal. Like you end up saying a lot of the same stuff because people are interested in the same kind of things. Like how'd you come up with the film or whatever? And like, there's only so many answers to that you can give. And usually there's only one answer that's actually the most honest, right? So I think that takes some getting used to. Like the first time you do it, you're sort of like, ugh, it's like the 10th time I've told this story. That's strange. And then you meet a bunch of people, which is awesome. And usually people who, you know, are passionate about the film and want to know more. And it's just such a pleasure to have that interface with, I guess, you know, a small part of the fan base of the film in a way, you know. Obviously, journalists is different than like a normal fan base, but yeah, people who care and are curious to know more.
Well, I'll try and keep things as fresh as possible then.
No worries. It's easier this time around.
I know. I mean, one of the things I was very sort of captivated by with the film, which I really enjoyed, by the way, is that it's a very old-fashioned film. And I don't even mean that in sort of a 10 or 15, 20 years ago. There is a sort of a gothic horror, almost the innocence vibe to it. And you're a relatively young director. So what made you make that film and not somebody running around in a mask stabbing people? What were your inspirations that way?
I don't know. Like, I guess we're in some ways like, you know, there's like the you are what you eat kind of phrase or whatever. And I think artistically, like whether you're a director, a musician or a journalist or whatever, the stuff you like is probably actually the best indication of the kind of stuff you should make in some way. Not always, but like, and for me, I grew up painting. Like I wanted to be an artist when I was a kid. And today still, like I show my paintings and do art shows and that kind of stuff. And while I was at art school, I started getting into cinema. I really liked this like popular form and that seemed to be this mess of like music and acting and lighting and camera and writing. Like it's a mix of 10 different arts, right? There's this French philosopher Alain Badiou. He says it's like an impure form, and I thought that was so cool. And he says it's democratic because it's impure, because not too highfalutin. And I think those are some of the reasons I was attracted to cinema. But so I'm coming from this place where it's like I studied art history all of my youth and in college, and like I'm really, you know, connected to, I love old objects. I love going to the Met and seeing like the Egyptian wing, the Greek wing, seeing Manet's paintings or Picasso's or whatever it is. And so I don't know, maybe that's part of why this film has this vibe or has the Goya paintings in it and that kind of thing. And then in terms of like film, I like a whole mix of films, but you know, today if we look at Netflix, I think like 90% of the films are in from the last 3 years or something. Like there's these graphs which are really actually sort of messed up. It seems like cultural amnesia, like we're sort of burying the old treasures that exist. But for me, I don't know. I really love romantic comedies from the 40s. I love Lubitsch. I love Pasolini. Like for a while, I was doing a bunch of shorts that like were sort of like replicas of Pasolini. So I don't know. I just follow my taste, you know. The stuff I love, the masters that I respect and really enjoy. Sometimes I try to just recreate it in some way. And some of the old vibes in this film, like definitely Suspiria was a reference. The Shining is like definitely one of my favorites of all time. And then I like some of these like ghost witch narratives from Japan, like Like Mizoguchi has a bunch of them, or Kuroneko is another one, which is just these like they're always mixing sex and ghosts and witches, and they're also period pieces, which I really love. So I don't know, maybe there's some of that in it.
Well, that's it. I mean, there is. I mean, obviously, people have sort of cell phones in the film, but you could very easily sort of chop those scenes out, and it could have been set 60 years ago, 50 years ago. You know, anytime it's sort of a timeless piece.
Totally.
Was that something that you wanted to do so it wasn't too contemporary, that sort of thing?
No, I didn't think so much. Obviously, like Amelia, the character is this character that has a particular relationship to time. And so I wanted that to be in the film and to be a foregrounded. And she lives in this old palace, which also tells a bit of her story and her family story. And these paintings have this relationship to history and stuff. So there should be this brooding history. I think that exists in a lot of horror, this like gothic old mansion, decrepit, and it's probably pointing towards some subconscious like nervousness about inheritance and aristocracy and old money. And I think a little bit of that is in the film. You know, I don't think about it too much or formalize it in a verbal way too much, but I do think that's there somehow.
Oh, definitely. There is that sort of, I mean, like you said, there are subtexts of different films that you've seen, but there is almost, you know, there's Dickensian sort of element to it, like Miss Havisham and that sort of thing as well, which there's that runs the whole way.
Totally. Yeah, I always wanted it to be have a little bit of a class aspect. It got a little reduced. Like I think Ed's characters were unclear exactly what class he is, but I definitely wanted at least this like contrast of cultures of like old, sort of decrepit, old money Europe, and then the sort of like naive, youthful US component that would sort of be a culture clash in a way.
Well, that's it. And I mean, it's a very European film. Tell me about sort of making a film that is, I mean, it's set in Portugal and sort of the concepts behind that, and why not sort of do something in an English speaking place, or you know, to have somewhere fill in for somewhere else. Tell me about that sort of production aspect to it and the story aspect as well.
So my family's from Portugal, and I grew up there until I was 4. Then I moved to the States. So I actually speak and write better in English than Portuguese. And then after art school, which I went to here in New York, I moved back to Portugal and tried to make a movie in the north of Portugal, where my grandma's from, where I spent the summers with all the people from the village, like a disaster film. But it actually ended up being an actual disaster. Like we couldn't finish the film because we were very, I guess we were still young and inexperienced and stuff. But then I stuck around Portugal and kept working, made a bunch of shorts, and Portugal has a really generous and great financing system for films. It's modest in its way, you know, because it's a small country, but they supported this film. They supported the previous one, Diamantino, and so that's part of it. That's how we managed it. You know, I produced this film with my partner Margarita, and that's how we got it made, was through this public financing in Portugal. And then in terms of Portugal, like, and the US, it mirrors a little bit my travel from the US to Portugal as well. So there's that part. And then I find this often, like I started working on a smaller project, these really short animations of ghosts fighting, arguing. And originally I had a more abstract concept that was like people from opposite sides of the political spectrum. Like you'll have somebody from the alt-right and somebody who's like a left-wing activist, and they're screaming at each other, but they're ghosts. It was sort of, you know, the picture of like where we'll be once the apocalypse happens. Like we'll still be arguing about the same stuff, but climate change killed everybody. And you know, when I was writing that, it wasn't personal enough for something. Like it still seemed a little vague. And as soon as I took the same concept but injected just a little bit of some of the stuff that is relevant to me on my in my daily life, all of a sudden it came to life. And in Amelia's Children, there's not so much of that, but I think the part about like traveling to Portugal from the States gave it maybe a little bit of that kind of resonance and meaning that's relevant to me.
And the opening portion of the film that is set in New York, was that shot in New York or did you have somewhere else double for that?
Yeah, so we shot in New York, but Carlota wasn't with us. We just shot plates. So definitely guerrilla DIY kind of filmmaking, you know, like this like a low budget film from Portugal. So I just came with Margarita, and we got a camera operator here from New York, And we just went out with like, you know, a pair of sticks and set it up at Bryant Park and planned the shots and did these zooms. And then we went to Birmingham Hill to get the stoop and stuff. And then the interior of the apartment we shot in Portugal is sort of like, you know, a studio built out the interior. And then we also replicated the stairs and the picnic furniture from Bryant Park and Birmingham Hill, and had Carlotto, you know, do his green screen plate on those, that then we composited with the New York stuff. So we were trying to use as many tricks as we had to keep the film cheap and light. And our main objective was like, we really wanted to do this film as a couple, you know, like sort of like keep it in the family. We didn't even have like a co-production with France or Brazil. As you still there? This cut out.
Yep, no, I'm
Yeah.
still here.
And so we had to be quite, you know, light on our feet. And that was one of the things how we handled the US shoot part of it was take as many tips from like the sort of 60s, making like Godard or Herzog or Cassavetes, you know, like how to shoot for cheap with the means you have.
Well, that's it. I mean, because that's why I asked the question, because I knew it was set in Portugal and there was a sequence in New York. I thought for a relatively, modest budgeted film, that's pretty good going to sort of go global. And
Yeah.
another question you sort of touched on, you come from a visual background. As somebody who's probably very visually minded when you're making a film, how does that work when you're dealing with performers and actors? Is that something that comes naturally, or are you always worried about the performance ruining the visual aspect? Talk me through that, please.
No, I love working with actors, and I think with actors, like, I think the main thing is like trust. Like, I really felt like Bridget, for example, trusted me a lot, and you know, if they had a doubt about a scene, and as anybody who's ever tried acting, everybody knows that it's one of the most insecure and vulnerable places you can put yourself is in front of a camera with 40 people on the other side of that camera, and you know, I'd give a suggestion to Bridget, and Bridget would really respond very openly, you know, sometimes suggesting things, sometimes questioning, you know, what I was suggesting. But like, for example, for the final act and sequence, I think it was about a week of screaming that Bridget was doing, which is quite exhausting. And Bridget was, I guess, unsure of how to scream, like what kind of scream, you know, because it's not this like cliche old fashioned like scream or whatever. And asked me what I thought, and it was just such a funny question because it's something that none of us think is a question. Like everybody knows how to scream. It's like knowing how to laugh or something. And I told Bridget like, you should scream like a moose. And I played like a little YouTube video of a moose. You know, there's like I think they're like moose mating calls or something. They're like these big bellowing, guttural, dissonant screams. And Bridget leaned into that, and if you watch the movie again with attention, that Bridget's really screaming like a moose, and it works so beautifully. So I don't know. That's I really love coming up with that kind of solution, and I guess the point of what I'm saying is like the trust of the actor in the director's sort of point of view is what's going to make that relationship the most fruitful possible. I feel like Annabella as well, who did Amelia, really really trusted me. Sometimes she was a little lost of like, how funny should this be and how creepy should it be? And little by little we constructed it together, and she really put her, you know, her trust that like I knew where I was going, you know, because I think Annabelle was a little more, you know, she would have been a little more conservative if it was just in her hands and like a little less humor or something, a little less tongue-in-cheek. But I don't know, I love those collaborations. Obviously, like the talent of the actor is so important, you know, like working with these actors was just such a pleasure.
Yeah, I mean, everybody gives great performances, in different aspects and different layers and different levels. So it's really, really good work from all of them. And just to wrap up finally here, once you're off the junket trail, what's next for you on a sort of directing level or?
I'm still picking. I wrote like five treatments, and they're very different. Some are like very weird, offbeat, like surreal thrillers. Like one takes place in Angola, another one in Silicon Valley. I'm really into those projects. And then I, oddly enough, really love kids' movies. Like I love Ratatouille and Inside Out and E.T. and Roger Rabbit. Like super passionate about those films. And I made two shorts that are sort of kids' movies. One's about a sculpture that runs away from the Louvre, and another one's about a little robot that's like learning to be a stand-up comedian in Brazil. And I'm grabbing those stories and making them into features as well, feature scripts. I don't know which one I'll do. And I also wrote one more horror film. It takes place in a church camp, which should be fun as well. But I don't know which one is the right film next, you know. But I'm excited about any of those ideas.
Well, I do you know off the back of this one, I'm really intrigued by sort of what you've got up your sleeve next. So I'll be keeping an eye out. I know we're sort of slightly over time here, so can I just say thank you for joining me and sort of chatting about the film, which, like I said, I really enjoyed.
Thank you so much.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Movies in Focus podcast. You can download it wherever you get your podcasts, and I hope that you tell your friends about it. That's it for this time. And I'll see you at the movies.